This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to treat summer joint pain naturally with chiropractor Dr. Emma Welpton. We'll learn how to navigate narcissism with trauma counselor and mental health expert Audrey Hope. We'll find out about the rise of longevity wellness with nutraceutical product assurance expert Ramandeep Sekhon. And lastly, we'll discover the connection between fall risks and cognitive decline with neuroscientist Dr. Ryan Darcy. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Millions of North Americans have blurry vision. And while many wear glasses or contacts, others choose LASIK, a laser eye surgery that reshapes the cornea. But LASIK comes with risks, like cutting into the eye, which can weaken it. Now scientists may have found a safer option. Professor Michael Hill and Dr. Brian Wong are working on a new technique called electromechanical reshaping, or EMR. Instead of lasers or blades, this method uses electricity to gently change the shape of the cornea. Here's how it works. They place a special platinum contact lens on the eye and run a tiny electrical current through it. This changes the chemistry of the cornea just enough to reshape it. After about a minute, the eye holds its new shape with no cuts needed. So far, they've tested this on rabbit eyes, and the results look promising. The hope is that one day people could get clearer vision with less risk and at lower cost. Stay tuned. This could be the future of vision correction. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Emma Welpton in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. For more than 30 years, Genestra brands have been trusted by health professionals across Canada. Their supplements are supported by scientific research and manufactured to meet high-quality standards. By combining traditional use with modern clinical evidence, Genestra provides professional-grade supplements that support your health. Learn more about their full range of products at genestra.ca. Dr. Emma Welpton is a chiropractor, a breath coach, and movement specialist. She helps people move, breathe, and perform better through science-backed recovery tools, breathwork, and mobility. So she probably knows a little bit about joint pain, which is what we're going to discuss today. How are you doing, Emma?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm actually doing pretty well today, although I must say, I'm recently back from holiday where we did a lot of hiking and walking, and I'm feeling it in my knees and I'm feeling it in my elbows. So I'm hoping you have some insights today that will help us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's start with the big picture. What do most people get wrong about pain?
Yeah, it's a great question. Most people believe that pain equals injury, and that's not typically the case. And it's not a direct correlation. Like you just said, you know, you were doing something great for your body. You were out hiking and super active, which a lot of people experience when they're on vacation. And then they end up with, you know, very classical, the knee pain. That's the first one, the hip pain, and just the generalized joint pain. It doesn't mean that you've injured the joint. It typically is more of a inflammatory response from doing an exercise that maybe your body wasn't used to, where we went, you know, we're not exercising frequently enough in that manner, or we worked out in a way that we lifted too much, or we took on too much load or stress for the joints. And so it doesn't equal, pain does not equal injury.
We should probably distinguish between an acute pain and a chronic pain, right? So like, I know enough that if I had done something in a workout or on a hike, and there's like a sharp bracing pain, I'm concerned about that. The type of pain that occurs after like going on a 2-hour hike, that's different. That's like your body recovering in most circumstances, right?
Totally. Most likely, yes. And typically, absolutely. When we think about acute pain, it is typically defined as more of like a short term, usually lasting less than 3 months. So even if it's like you went on that hike and you had the joint pain and it's lasting 2 weeks, it's still considered an acute pain. When we think about chronic pain, that's more persistent, beyond normal healing time, and often longer than that 3 months. So anytime we have pain shorter than 3 months, it's typically falling under that umbrella of acute pain, more short term. Anything past the 3 months that's been lingering and lasting more consistent and persistent falls under chronic pain.
Why do you think so many people struggle to understand or manage chronic pain? What's the problem?
Oh, chronic pain is a tricky one, because pain is perceived. Well, that's just it. Pain is perceived. It's not exactly what's happening in the tissue. Let's say we have an injury and it lasts 3, 4, 6 months. Some people are dealing with chronic injuries that are years in the making and in the process, and it's a year-long journey or multiple years. And when it comes down to that, chronic pain is very much perceived in your nervous system. And the nervous system really likes to almost take the path of least resistance, and it goes, okay, we've been processing this pain in our brain from your knee for the last 16 months. And so we're not going to waste our resources to check in every 10 minutes with the knee and say, oh, is there actually a reason to process pain in the brain? When it's been processing those same neurological signals for so long, your body's like, we got it. We understand what's going on. We don't even need to check in with the knee. We're going to go on that automatic response and go, ooh, there's pain, there's pain, there's pain. And so it becomes this nervous system issue instead of necessarily a physical issue. And when we deal with true chronic pain, a lot of the time we're not looking at fixing an injury. We're looking at how do we rewire the nervous system and sort of recalibrate the nervous system to no longer process that pain.
And I think we sort of touched on this earlier. Pain isn't necessarily a sign that something is broken, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Can you have pain even when there's no clear physical injury?
Totally. Think of like phantom pain, right? You don't even have your limb. It's your right arm is completely gone, and people will still feel the pain in their right arm. Absolutely.
You work with movement and breath, two things that seem simple but are sometimes overlooked. Why do movement and pain play such a big role in managing pain?
Movement is so key because it's what helps pump the blood flow, right? Yeah. And when we can think about healing, when we think about healing modalities, whether it's like an ultrasound that you're receiving at your chiropractor's or physiotherapist or whatever it is, or just using a heating pad on your back or massage therapy, everything is revolving around this idea and this theory that we're increasing blood flow to the area to help it heal.
Right, because some of these areas don't have a great deal of blood flow through them, right? So for example, I have a partially torn Achilles, okay? I'm not going to get surgery. It's not there, but I can tell you it causes a fair bit of pain from time to time. And movement actually helps it because it's an area of cartilage where there is very low blood flow. Is that what you're talking
about? Exactly. Yeah. So we're able, there's so many reasons why movement is a crucial player in pain management. And a big one is exactly that. Yeah. We're increasing blood flow to the cells to help heal and recover any damaged tissue. We also think about movement is key for pumping your lymphatic system, right? Your lymphatic system your lymphatic system, for some context, helps clear out waste products. It helps flush out inflammation. We can think of it that way. And it doesn't have a pump. So there's not a pump that's like, okay, let's start flushing out inflammation. Your muscles contracting is the pump. So how do we get the muscles to contract, to pump out that inflammation, especially when we're thinking about like the lower legs, the Achilles that you mentioned, right? We're working against gravity. So we really need some contraction of the muscles to pump that lymphatic fluid, to pump inflammation out of the area of, you know, potential injury.
Okay. So movement makes total sense to me. You're going to have to elaborate on how breath comes into pain management.
Okay, I love this. And that's where most people are confused. And they're like, what do you mean? How does my breath have anything to do with my pain management? And going back to understanding this idea that pain is perceived in the brain, and your brain is a main part of your nervous system, and your breath controls, it's the remote control of your nervous system. So pain is amplified and worsened when we are in a fight or flight state. Pain is amplified when we're stressed out. And most of us live in a modern world that can be very stressful, whether it's traffic, your job, your kids, your partner, whatever it is. Your breath is with you at all times, and it can directly impact your stress levels and bring that stress level down, take you out of fight or flight state, and decrease the pain that your body is perceiving simply because of the state of your nervous system. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, it helps regulate your brain. So I suppose, are you saying it helps regulate your brain such that the brain is not paying attention to the pain? Or are you saying something else?
So what happens is that when you're stressed out, and we can really understand this in our day-to-day lives, when we're already agitated and stressed, the small things feel like bigger things, right?
Yeah, of course.
You know, when you're sitting on the beach and you spill your drink and you're like, ah, no big deal. It's all good. Life is good. Versus you're stressed, you're running, you're late, you spill your coffee and you're like about to have a total meltdown. And that's because your body is already stressed. Your nervous system is stressed. And in those states, we feel pain more. So without changing the physical body, without changing your injury, we can change your nervous system to bring your nervous system down from this like fight or flight, super stressed out state, bring it down into this like, I'm on the beach, life is good. You don't actually have to be on the beach, but you bring your nervous system down to what we call your rest and digest, your parasympathetic state. And that's where life feels a little bit slower, everything feels a little bit easier, and you feel a little bit more calm and at ease. And in that state, your brain is less on alert. Your nervous system is less on alert. You're less on its tippy toes. So when a pain signal comes up, it's like, sure, we feel the pain, but we're safe. We're calm. It's okay. Sure, maybe we'll feel that pain, but is the pain as intense? No. So when we're stressed, pain is amplified, and we can use our breath to calm our nervous system down so that the pain that you're feeling feels less intense to us. We're perceiving it in a different way. One of the easiest ways that we can calm our nervous system down, right? And again, your nervous system controls everything. It controls the way that your brain perceives stress, the way your brain perceives pain. It controls your metabolism. It controls everything in your body. All of the systems that are happening happen from signals from your nervous system. And your breath can change your nervous system. So one of the most powerful tools that we can have to decrease our stress levels and to change our nervous system state, bring it down, calm it down, is something called the cyclic sigh. It's really easy to do. And I love teaching this because no matter where you are, your breath is always with you and it's free. You're sitting in your car, in traffic, or you're in a meeting, you're always breathing, and you can always breathe in a way that supports your desired outcome or the way that you want to feel. So the cyclic sigh is taking a deep breath in, and it's like this fast breath into the lower part of your belly. So it's a full fast breath in, and then you take another sip of air at the top, and then an exhale out through the mouth. And it's almost like this sigh all the way out. And you kind of just like let it go and sigh it all the way out. And when we do that 2 to 3 times, we change our nervous system. We change the way that our internal physiology is working. We decrease our nervous system. We downregulate it, which ultimately downregulates our pain, decreases the amount and the severity that pain is being perceived as.
Okay. So I'm greatly relieved about the type of breath work you are espousing, because I thought you were going to do the breathe in through one nostril and breathe out through the other, which stymies me.
No.
I can't do it. I've found, so because of my Achilles, I have to do a series of stretches both before and after my workouts. And I exercise, in addition to like walking and hiking, I have workouts that I do 5 times a week. And this has probably increased the amount of time. So like what will be 45 minutes of hard exercise gets expanded to like an additional half hour of stretching with 15 before and 15 after. But I've been trying to incorporate sort of a mindfulness element to the stretches after with some breathing so that it becomes sort of intuitive and I can work it into my day. Because I think the hardest part for people today is finding the time to do, even if it's something as simple as breath work, finding the time to do it. Are you finding that with your patients and the people you consult with?
Absolutely. And that's always going to be most people's objection to anything, you know, move more, do this, do that, whatever it is. We are already fully jam-packed and stressed and live in a very go, go, go world. And finding more time to do things feels like it's adding to the stress. And, you know, how I typically respond to that is that we're breathing all the time anyways. So it's just a matter of becoming aware of your breath and integrating that into your moments where you don't have to change your schedule or integrate any more time into your schedule to do the breath work. It's you're breathing all the time anyway. So great example, it's like you're stretching your Achilles. While I'm stretching my Achilles, how am I breathing right now?
Yeah.
Because if it's shallow and short into my chest, I'm actually telling my nervous system that I'm stressed. And when I'm stressed, my muscles aren't going to relax. My body's not going to be healing as optimally as it could be, right? My pain is being perceived higher than it could be versus, am I breathing slow? Am I breathing through my nose? Am I breathing deep into my belly? Because if you're doing that, you're downregulating your nervous system, which helps your injury heal faster and your pain to feel less.
Let's get real for a minute. We're talking about pain relief. What do you think reasonable expectations are? So let's just use my example. You can pick another if you don't like it. So I have, you know, a partially torn Achilles. Doesn't mean I'm in pain all the time, but it means that there's a low-grade pain a lot of the time. In doing this breath work, what are reasonable expectations in terms of pain management?
It really differs and is dependent on the case-by-case study. People with chronic pain, that their pain is a little bit more hardwired into their nervous system, they're going to have better benefits of doing the breath work and maybe a more immediate noticeable change from doing the breath work. They downregulate their nervous system, they feel relaxed, and they're like, wow, that made a huge difference in my pain. Somebody who has a little bit more chronic pain might notice a bigger difference with the breath. Somebody that's got a little bit more of an acute pain situation, maybe higher inflammatory levels, would maybe notice less, but it doesn't necessarily need to be noticeable to be making a difference on a physiological level. And again, we know that when your body is relaxed and when we're calm on a cellular level, you heal faster. So even though you might not notice a change in your pain in this moment, that's not to say that it heals faster than if you hadn't been integrating this mindful breathwork practice, you know, and it, you know, long game, right? It heals faster. So therefore you're out of pain faster.
Time for one last question. And that is for anyone who's listening or feeling hopeless or burnt out from trying to fix their pain, what would you say to them?
Day by day, like take a deep breath, understand that healing is not linear. Understand that we are at a time where we have so many resources, which can be such a beautiful thing, but can also be really overwhelming. So to me, it's like, get back to the basics, take a deep breath, understand it's not linear, sleep well. Our body heals when we're sleeping, do the basics, eat well, right? Fuel your body with nutrient dense foods and maybe add in some supplements to help with decreasing inflammation. But it's like, get back to the basics, take a deep breath, sleep well, and eat well, you know, gentle movement on the body. And it's a day by day thing. It, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. it's easier said than done to not feel overwhelmed by it. Cause I understand when you're in the weeds, when you're in the midst of it, it can feel very overwhelming and daunting. But just remember, it's a slow process. And the biggest thing that you can do is just be consistent. And if you can't get your sleep down, if you can't get your supplement routine down, if you can't get your nutrition or your movement down, that's okay. Pick one and be consistent with it. And that will give you the biggest outcome.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Emma Welpton. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss dealing with narcissists on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wildcrafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Audrey Hope is a distinguished figure in the healing arts, boasting over two decades of experience in spiritual and transformative healing. Known for her profound ability to heal at the deep level of the spirit, Audrey employs revolutionary techniques aimed at transforming the root of the soul. Her methods are comprehensive and versatile, addressing this life, past life, and the other side, soul contracts, karma, and energy. Based in the heart of Brentwood, CA, Audrey operates her own practice, where she continues to serve a diverse clientele. Welcome to the show, Audrey. How are you?
Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Jamie.
So I'm on Instagram a lot. I do a lot of surfing, and it's interesting how themes come up and sort of proliferate at certain times. I wouldn't say necessarily in the last month or so, but let's say within the last 6 months, what I've noticed is there's a lot of talk about narcissism and how to identify who a narcissist is and how to know when you have a relationship with sort of a narcissist and how to deal with it, which is interesting to me because some people have accused me of narcissistic tendencies. So,
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting for me to find out whether like I'm a toxic narcissist. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. And, you know, what you can do if you're not and somebody's being unkind to you. So can you help us with that today?
Well, first of all, I think it was Karen Horney who said it's a spectrum. You know, it's on a spectrum like narcissism. So there's many different kinds of narcissism, okay? And,
yeah.
And you know, where do you fall in an extreme version of it? But for me, as a healer, it comes down to the selfishness of it and being in a relationship. Are you with someone who's very selfish, who makes you feel bad? You're always blaming yourself. So these are the things about being in a relationship with a narcissist. And with the self, it's always good to self-reflect, Jamie, to ask yourself, you know, am I being selfish in the world? Can I be the best person that I can be? That's really good that you're even questioning it, because that's the work we all need to do. And with social media has made us all kind of narcissists.
I agree.
Because we're always self-promoting, right? So it's the nature of the timing, right? But it's good because a lot of us have wonderful things to say. And I'm glad that we have this platform that everyone in this time period can contribute. But with the self, it's always good to self-reflect. And people may tell you that, and you have to ask yourself, What is it for me to hear? What can I do to improve myself? Because most narcissists won't do that. If you're a real extreme narcissist, you won't be asking that question. So I just want to say off the bat, the fact that you're concerned about it, I don't think you're too extreme on the spectrum.
That's true, but we've only met each other for the last couple of minutes, so you really don't know. But
you're asking the question, Jamie, and most narcissists don't come to treatment. They'll only come if they have anxiety or some other problem, maybe addiction. But they're usually the ones that come are the partners of the narcissist.
I hear you. I also wonder whether the term narcissism has been expanded to explain a bucket full of behaviors that aren't necessarily classic narcissism. And I also wonder whether or not there are some positive aspects of narcissism. In other words, it takes a fair bit of will to be successful in our North American society. And I think sometimes you kind of have to put yourself forward in order to get things done. That doesn't make you a good person. But if you're trying to achieve something, I think you kind of need a big ego, and you need to kind of put yourself first in order to get things done.
I think you put the nail on the head. That's very well put, because it's okay to have some narcissistic tendencies, which is love of self,
yep,
and all that you're saying. It's very important. That's a very important point.
Okay, but let's look at the flip side, which is really why I brought you on the show. How do you know if you're in a relationship with a narcissist and it isn't a healthy one? So what are some of the hallmarks?
You always feel bad. You always blame yourself. You don't feel good enough. You think it's all your fault, and you don't call it out. You're in denial. You see, you're in denial, and you're in an illusion about who you're with. So that's a very important point. You have to call out. A pen is a pen. What color paint is on the wall? You got to be in reality and insanity, which is to call it out. I am with a narcissist. That's a very important thing. But you usually feel guilty when you're with a narcissist. You think it's your fault, and you're always trying to fix them, save them, understand them, make excuses for them. And that is the danger points. You must stop doing all that and look at yourself and work on your self-esteem and your self-love. I don't know if you can change a narcissist, but what you can do is change yourself.
Well, I wonder if narcissists kind of gravitate towards those people who have low self-esteem. In other words,
that is exactly right.
And so, like, how shall I put this? I'm big on self-responsibility. Everybody has their frailties. Everybody comes into this world. It's kind of like a yin-yang thing, right? We have our strengths. We have our weaknesses. And some people are get-along type people. They don't have strong egos. They're people-pleasers. But it can devolve into sort of victimhood, I think. And I also think narcissists tend to target those people and develop relationships with them because they know exactly what kind of people they are.
That's beautifully said. But as a soul healer, I look at everything as alchemy. All the world's a stage,
yeah,
and all the men and women merely players. So people play parts for us. So the focus is not on them. You need to take the focus back on you and self-reflect with a mirror and say, what am I doing in this relationship? What is this about for me? And what do I need to heal? And that's really the important point, which is what I call your soul wound, your primal wound that you call it karma, call it your soul theme, what you came to earth to heal. And that's what I do. I look higher. And that's my gift, to be able to go a little higher, like on a carpet above, and look, why am I in this? And that's the important point. What are you supposed to heal? Why are you with someone why you're taking crumbs? Why are you taking less than? That is the question. Why do you stay? Of course, it feels familiar. We always try to find home. That's through law of attraction. If we're unhealed, we'll always try to find what's familiar. We, even in an abusive relationship, that could be familiar to you. But the healing point is, what are you doing about it? What are you doing? Why are you staying? And why don't you make some changes to love yourself and heal yourself?
So let's kind of define the emotional or psychological effects of being in a relationship with a narcissist. So what does that look like typically?
It looks like I work at Seasons Rehab. I've been there for 15 years, okay? So I work in every capacity, trauma, addiction, you name it. I've had the privilege to sit with people. And do you know how many people are in there because of a relationship that's damaged them? It's mind-boggling. And so you have to sit and go, you know, what are you doing? It always comes down to relationships healing. It's really interesting. And so, again, they're not the ones in treatment. The partner is, right? Mm-hmm. So it looks like you're destroyed, maybe even suicidal, wondering what to do, and hoping that person can change. I always say, look at the wall. Can you say to the wall, please love me? I mean, it's impossible to get someone else to change. But if you really make yourself magnificent, do the healing, believe me, your life will change.
So if someone is of the view that they're in a narcissistic relationship, what do you think the first step is that they should be taking?
They need to call it out. I am with a very selfish person. I do not deny. You know, so much, Jamie, about healing is denial. Are you in denial about who you're with? Are you trying to fix them? You don't want to look at it. But, you know, if you call it out, it's very powerful. I'm with a narcissist. I'm not going to try and fix them anymore. I'm going to stop that. That's the beginning of healing.
Okay. But are there really that many narcissists? I mean...
Oh, yes.
Let me rephrase. Are there that many narcissists that are incapable of change? In other words, if it, you know, off the top, you said it's a spectrum, right? Like it's not black and white, right? Like, yeah. So there are narcissists and then there are narcissists. So maybe you have somebody with narcissistic tendencies. Is it possible for them, if they're not sort of, I guess we'll call it like at the one end of the spectrum, the deep ebony black narcissist, if you're not that, are you capable of changing?
Well, Jamie, because I work with addicts, mm-hmm. it's a tough crowd.
Yeah.
Tough crowd, my husband would say. And as a healer, bringing in new revolutionary techniques, you know, and new perspectives, I truly believe that it's possible if someone would take the time and look at themselves that they can heal. I do believe, me personally, in miracles. I have witnessed it. That's why this work is so rewarding, because I have seen tremendous changes. When you really take away shame and guilt from someone and give them the opportunity to change. So I work with a lot of rich celebrities, men, you know, people have really made it in the world. And yes, they are really, you know, they have a reason. They've succeeded. They have a lot of clout, but they've never really looked at, you know, that original wound of self-esteem. So, you know, behind narcissism is low self-esteem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, more men are narcissists than women, right? That's like a statistic. I'm not sure of exactly that statistic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you get men to sit down and not try and, you know, always put that mask on that they're perfect. And you get them a little vulnerable to talk about their feelings. There's so much hope there for change. So in answer to your question, I have seen change where it has seemed impossible, and I do believe in it. And the answer is yes.
Okay, we have time for one last question, and that is, how can someone begin to reclaim their sense of self after being in a narcissistic relationship? What are the things that need to happen?
Well, because I don't have a lot of time, sometimes I only get 50 minutes with someone, and then they might leave the treatment center. I got to work fast, right? So I appreciate your question. And that is about boundaries. To work on boundaries, I will no longer put myself down. I will no longer give my power away energetically to this relationship. Energy is a big piece in my healing, which is you got to take back your energy from where you leaked it, right? Mm-hmm. This person drained you. Could be a psychic vampire. You got to suck back in your energy. So the boundaries, I am no longer going to put myself down. I'm going to honor myself in the sovereignty of the self and love myself. And those boundaries are so powerful, and healing can happen almost in a moment when you make a commitment to take those boundaries.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
That was Audrey Hope. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss longevity wellness on The Tonic.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Ramandeep Sekhon is a product expert and regulatory affairs and quality assurance manager at Nature Sunshine. Born and raised in Chicago, she earned a bachelor's in psychology and natural sciences from Loyola University and studied medical sciences at Windsor University School of Medicine. She later completed a postgraduate certificate in regulatory affairs at Humber College in Toronto. Welcome to the show, Ramandeep. How are you?
Hi, Jamie. Thank you for having me. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So I can tell you that one of the hot button issues that we deal with on the show, particularly in the last 6 months or so, has been longevity and health span. They become huge areas of interest across the wellness world, and I'm sure you're seeing it from your end too. From your perspective, what does longevity wellness really mean, and why are more people turning to supplements as part of this journey?
Yes, so it has become a big trend, and I think it became a big trend after that Netflix series Don't Die by Brian Johnson. Like, everyone just wants to live longer, right? That's what people think longevity is. But I think longevity is really about adding life to the years that we have. So by staying active, we want to make sure we're maintaining our neuroplasticity, we're maintaining our mobility, we're recovering well from illnesses, and just being independent as we age. I think that is true longevity. More people are turning to supplements because they recognize that lifestyle plays a huge role in how we age, right? So even with a healthy diet and exercise, our bodies naturally produce less of certain compounds, less enzymes, less hormones over time. And I think people are going to supplements because it helps bridge those gaps and supports the function that our body may not be supporting anymore. And I also think that what is fueling this shift is that people have more access to the internet. They can research ingredients, they can read the studies, they can make informed choices. So they feel empowered to take natural, proactive approach to healthy aging and longevity. I don't know if you can agree with me, but growing up, my parents, I've never saw them take any supplements because I just feel like their generation didn't have access to the internet like we do. So the only thing I remember my parents ever telling me was, drink your orange juice. It has vitamin C, during that flu season, when yep. we start school. But that's the only thing I would see my parents do. And I really think it's because of the accessibility to internet and the choices that we have now.
I agree with you. I'm all about health span. In other words, if we're going to live longer, hopefully we're living better so we can actually enjoy the extra years we're getting. And mm-hmm. that's what I'm all about. So let's focus in on one of those supplements that you just kind of mentioned generally. L-arginine is often referred to as the miracle molecule. Can you explain how it earned that moniker and reputation?
Yeah, so arginine has earned that nickname largely because of its role as a precursor to nitric oxide. So what is fascinating is that before scientists were studying nitric oxide as a gas, right? They thought nitric oxide had no role in our human body. But then in the 1980s and the 1990s, they discovered that nitric oxide is actually produced in our bodies. And it comes from L-arginine. So that connection was a breakthrough. That connection also received the Nobel Prize Award in 1998. So that showed us that arginine isn't just an amino acid anymore. It became like this key to unlocking nitric oxide, which really is important because it regulates blood flow. It supports our cardiovascular system. It basically touches every single part in our body. So without arginine, the body can't produce optimal amounts of nitric oxide. And without nitric oxide, arginine wouldn't have the same reputation it has for cardiovascular and longevity benefits. And it wouldn't be called the miracle molecule.
Okay, so can you sort of walk us through how L-arginine is converted into nitric oxide within our bodies?
Yeah, so I'll just keep it very simple. So we have L-arginine in our bodies, right? And then there is an enzyme called nitric oxide synthase, which converts it to nitric oxide in our body. So we need arginine present in our body, and then we have this enzyme called nitric oxide synthase, which converts it to nitric oxide, and then nitric oxide does its job.
Okay, so cardiovascular health is obviously, you know, central and important for right. for feeling well and feeling young and extending our lives. How does L-arginine support circulation and help maintain cardiovascular health in this context?
Okay, so it's really important to note that arginine and nitric oxide go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. And arginine is that specific amino acid that we need. So when I talk about arginine, I'm also just talking about nitric oxide because we can't have one or the other. It has to be both things. So healthy circulation is when you're blood flow smoothly, right? There's oxygen and nutrients going wherever they're needed. But as we age, our blood vessels stiffen and then our nitric oxide levels naturally decline. So by the time we're in our 40s or 50s, we're making about half as much as we did in our 20s. And that's why that's the big reason why stamina declines and heart health and cardiovascular health becomes such a focus with aging. But then we have arginine, supplements like arginine, that can support your cardiovascular health by stimulating nitric oxide production. So that will help, you know, your blood vessels to relax, keep them more flexible, improve circulation. So the result is that you get less strain on your heart. There's better delivery of the oxygen to the brain and muscles, and it supports healthy blood pressure. So it basically, you know, translates to more vitality. If you have all those things going to the right places, you get more vitality, more stamina, and you protect the important systems as we age, and that's our cardiovascular system. So nitric oxide and arginine work hand in hand, and we need both to sustain cardiovascular health and longevity.
Okay. So if our body's ability to produce arginine decreases as we get older.
Right.
Is it because our bodies don't function as well, or is it because it can't process L-arginine from the foods and nutrients that we're taking in, or is it both?
I think it's both, to be honest. Like, as we age, our body is not the same, right?
Yeah.
Like, we just can't recover from illnesses or injuries like we did in our 20s. And that's the normal aging process. So things will decline, things, you know, enzymes don't work as they did. And even arginine, like we do get arginine from food sources, like protein sources, but it's not enough to sustain the nitric oxide. So that's the reason why supplementing with arginine is beneficial.
Okay. The ingredient has been the subject of research by leading cardiovascular specialists. Why has it attracted so much scientific attention, and what excites you most about the findings so far?
I think the biggest, like, why it's attracted so much scientific attention is that because it opened up an entirely new way of looking at vascular health. So, like, instead of just managing your symptoms, they found a natural compound that can just help the body restore its own vascular function. And I think that's why top cardiologists are so interested in it and researched it, because it's a natural supplement, right? So it's a natural thing that you can take on your own to support yourself. It's not just managing your systems. It's helping your body take an arginine and then it create more nitric oxide. And what excites me the most is that L-arginine is not just for your heart health. It's basically touches every single part of your body. It goes to your, the more blood flow you have, the better brain function you have, the better muscle performance and recovery. You have healthier skin, and it even helps with sexual vitality. So it's really rare to find a single supplement that can impact so many aspects of aging. And I think that's the most exciting part of it. And it's like a central hub for longevity.
Okay, time for last questions. And that is, if somebody's interested in incorporating L-arginine into their routine, what's the best ways for us to take it? For example, how do we supplement on a daily basis? Like, what would you do to promote healthy aging?
I would think of it as like a wellness drink. I think powder format is the best way to go, because with capsules, you can only fit so much in, and you would have to take a handful to just reach that therapeutic level. So powder form is the best because it allows for higher amounts of arginine, and depending on the formulation and the product, it might have other cofactors. So, and I think it mixes really well with smoothies. So if you're making a smoothie in the morning, you just add a scoop of arginine in and you're good to go. And but with any supplements, you know, it's always very important to consult a qualified healthcare practitioner before starting, especially if you have existing health conditions or if you're pregnant or breastfeeding. But it's a great wellness drink. You can mix it with anything. It mixes very well. And it's a great in smoothies. Okay. That's how I recommend taking it.
Okay, $64,000 question. Does it have a funny taste, or is it tasteless if you take it in the powder form?
Depends, right? It depends on which formulation you're getting. Some companies make like add flavors, so it tastes like a wild berry flavor.
Yeah.
Some might just keep it plain, and it really depends on if you're mixing it in a smoothie. You have other ingredients, so it might just, you know, you might not even taste it. So it really depends on the formulation, depends on what, like, if there's any flavors added, depends on what type of smoothie you're making. But, you know, you try it. You have to play around and see how it works for you.
And your company, Nature Sunshine, does it come in flavors, or is it neutral?
I think it's the wild berry flavor, if I'm not wrong.
Okay.
But it's a beautiful formulation. It contains other ingredients as well to support aging and cellular energy.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jamie.
We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at the Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Ryan Darcy, PLENG, is a neuroscientist and neurotechnology entrepreneur. He's the co-founder and chief science officer of Health Tech Connects. He also holds professorship appointments at Simon Fraser University and the University of British Columbia, where he serves as BC Leadership Chair in Neuroimaging and Neurotechnology. Dr. Darcy has led the development of numerous innovations to improve brain health, including the Health and Technology District in Surrey, BC. He has attracted more than $100 million in competitive research funding and been recognized through numerous awards and distinctions. Jim Kloss, a kinesiologist, also has 34 years of experience in managing, distributing, educating, launching innovative products and services within the aging in place and falls prevention space. Jim has always focused on the preventative side of how technology and services can be integrated to make lives easier and safer. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie.
So I understand that there may be a connection between falls risks and cognitive decline. Can you explain that to us?
Certainly. I can jump in and say that there is absolutely a connection. First of all, Our balance and our gait are, I sometimes refer to them as a canary in the coal mine for our brain health. So as we age and our brain is aging, it increases the likelihood of falls risks. And then with falls risks, a number of those actually then can result in a concussion. So there's a definite connection between the two.
How could you measure the falls risk of an individual?
Well, you can, there are ways to measure it through balance. There's some pretty advanced now balance measurements that break your balance actually into how you balance is how you see things, how you feel things, and what's called your vestibular system, which is usually when you spin yourself, what gets you dizzy. So those three inputs collectively help us balance. And when we can actually empirically measure all three of those, and when those start to go below normal levels, that increases your falls risk.
I'll jump in there, Jamie.
Yeah.
I'll jump in there to say that things like stride length and stride speed are all indicators as well. And some of the technology can pick up these really quickly as well. So that ties back into what Dr. Darcy was saying about the whole vestibular system. So now we can track it very empirically and objectively.
So we frequently have guests come on the show in the context of sort of doing medical testing like blood tests and serum tests, et cetera. They talk about the importance of a baseline. Is that relevant when you're talking about measuring somebody's falls risks or even cognition? Do we need to know what their baseline was, let's say, at a younger age? Or is it relevant just to sort of take the average and then work from there?
It's always helpful to get a baseline. I don't necessarily think you need it from a younger age. I think anyone can baseline their current measurements now to find out how their balance is. And as Jim said, he's completely correct about how their gaits is and that sort of thing. We do that routinely in our clinic. I think the cool part about even whether or not you get a baseline or not, these functions are what we call neuroplastic. So they're actually something you can train, which is probably what I'd want the listeners to know is you want to get a baseline because you can actually train it and improve it and reduce your falls risk. So why wouldn't you do that?
So what tools are used to actually measure somebody's cognitive decline?
Well, thank you for asking. We actually historically have had real challenges understanding someone's cognition. The brain for many of us is, and for all of us really, is mysterious and super complex. What we do here is we actually have developed a objective measure of cognitive brain function that we measure with a Canadian-born technology called NeuroCatch. It's a portable technology. It's quick. It's kind of like a blood pressure cuff for your brain. And that gives us instantly an objective measure of how your cognitive function is relative to normal ranges.
Okay, so relative to normal ranges. Again, I've had guests come on the show, neuroscientists, who talk about the importance of getting baseline as well. Because I think we know even at a younger age, there are people with better cognition levels than others. Is that not also relevant when you're tracking somebody who's older?
Baselines, again, similar to falls risks, gait, balance, and all those things, baselines are always helpful. But one of the things that's important is it's really critical to know where things are for you right now in terms of your cognition. We can compare that. We have the brain scanner allows us to get a lot of data quickly, so we can compare that to where you should be for your age and different aspects of your demographics and lifestyle. And then again, same thing with balance, with cognition, it's actually trainable. So you can take your brain to the brain gym and you can improve your cognition, you can improve your balance. And that's the key message I'd want viewers to have and listeners to have, because that's something that we're really is exploding forward as a breakthrough in neuroscience, is understanding that we can actually move the dial in our brain health.
Okay. In addition to measuring gait and doing tests on cognition, I understand that there are other tests that are undertaken with the work that you guys are doing. Can you explain a little bit about the other tests as well?
I'll take that, Ryan. So the taking the NeuroCatch, for example, out of a laboratory and getting it into the hands of people, basically in their homes or whatever living arrangements they have, is what we're trying to do. Some of the more traditional tests like grip strength and depth perception we include as well, because these are tried and true laboratory tested tests that give you a level of fragility of somebody, and you know, having that again as a baseline can show the improvements that any sort of intervention or exercise program given to the individual, you can track that better. So in the depth perception side of things, not a lot of people think of that, but it is very critical with falls risk, because slightly different than vision when you're talking about changes of level or going down a set of stairs, for example. So those are two of the other key measurements that we take.
So my understanding is that, you know, you're administering these tests for people that come to you with the purpose of, you know, determining care planning going into the future, right? Like, you're not just taking tests for the hell of it. You want to create a picture so that care could be more individualized. So
exactly. Yeah.
In that context, what are sort of the results that you, like, what sort of information is gleaned such that you can actually personalize somebody's care going forward? Like, what's the difference between what you're doing and the type of care somebody might be getting at wherever, you know, wherever they're staying, whether it's in a home facility or whether they're in home, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, Ryan has touched on it briefly. It's the objective numbers that we're getting. A lot of traditional risk or falls risk predictors are survey-based, very subjective to the person giving the test to an individual. So the results don't come back 100% accurate a lot of time. So devices like NeuroCatch, we have an objective number that can be compared over time. And as we said, interventions, whether it be physical exercise, and Ryan did lean on to taking your brain to the gym for the day. There's lots of modalities that he's researching that would actually then, upon a follow-up test, give you indicators whether it's declining, you're the same, or you're improving. And in most cases, it's going to improve because you're actually taking steps towards improving your physical and cognitive abilities.
So beyond suggesting the types of treatments, are there ways, like, in other words, are you suggesting that certain people might want to sort of proof their facilities to prevent falls, like, and put in products? Or, like, as a result of getting the test, what does one do other than sort of test their brain and make sure perhaps they're stretching or doing balancing exercises?
Yeah, there's very specific exercise programs that are handed to somebody in the terms of gait. There's very specific exercises around brain training that we get from NeuroCatch scores. And these, if you're in a commutative setting, go through the program's directors or the nursing staff to implement as part of a care plan. And part of the reason that we're trying to do this objective measure is to actually improve the staffing of, or at least the ability of staff in these homes, because they're so overstimulated and overworked that if we give them very pinpoint programming, it'll help personalize the care for those individuals outside of the care homes or the retirement settings and in the individual homes. Then, yeah, it's very much up to the individual and how they want to, you know, take control of their life and exercise programs and cognitive exercise programming.
So what are reasonable expectations for treatment and or results based on the data that you're collecting? Like, what are the demonstrable changes and improvements that one might expect to see?
It's the first reasonable expectation is that we often don't have a sense of that we have control over our brain health. And what we're really, our main message here is that in medicine, you can't treat what you can't measure. So when we start using these objective measures, they're sensitive to changes, and it allows and enables people to take control over their brain health. We with the measurement, we're actually discovering a lot of potential really accessible things to do. So there's a lot of breakthroughs in lifestyle habit things that help brain health that scientists is learning really quickly and medicine is learning really quickly. But then, as Jim mentioned, there's now a tremendous surgence of accessible apps that help, you know, folks that are playing Wordle, for example. That's actually really good for cognitive abilities, and we can measure that and show that. So reasonable expectations are that you can take control and you can start to focus focus on goals and objectives. Once you know where you might want to improve, it might be in attention, it might be in your memory, in your comprehension. And we routinely can see gains in that throughout life. One of the key things that's moving forward is this concept of frailty. Jim kind of mentioned it earlier. What we like with healthy aging is to get people focused on basically taking activities that prevent rapid frailty and keep them robustly active and enjoying life.
If people are interested in learning more, where can they go online to find out the information?
You can hit our website, which is simply carefall.ca.
Yep. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Emma Welpton, Audrey Hope, Ramandeep Sekhon, and Dr. Ryan Darcy. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at janie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.